quick so that I knew her next words would be important. She had convinced herself that she was to blame for their deaths. I remained silent, letting the idea grow in the light between us. The image of the poor, orphaned girl whose presence had wrought so many deaths. And then, though I couldn't explain why, I felt as though something had been decided. As if Maud had used the time, the silence, to question, to ponder, to decide. She turned to me, and I no longer saw a lost and confused woman, but rather one with a purpose, with a plan. Her eyes narrowed. "I was sorry to hear about your family's misfortunes. I had meant to tell you that earlier." "Oh?" I asked, eyebrows raised, eager to see what it was that she seemed to have arrived upon, and what part Sophie Turner would have to play in it. "Yes." She paused. "You see, I have an idea, but it would require some assistance." When I did not object, she continued, "I would need you to do something for me in Spain, if you thought you could manage it, and you would be compensated, of course, for your time. Alice receives a small monthly allowance from her trust, and I could have this sum forwarded to you there in the meantime. The bank would handle all the details, so you wouldn't have to worry about a thing." "Yes, I see," I said, though I didn't quite, not just yet. But I knew that I would soon, that Maud trusted me completely, that she believed the woman who sat before her, Sophie Turner, was good and decent and worth helping. And while it was true that I had already made a plan, I was intrigued to see where Maud was heading, if her plan might be more beneficial in the long run. I weighed the risks, considered the odds, brought to mind that sad, anonymous room in the boarding house, and quickly agreed. Maud nodded in acknowledgement. "Her behavior today has convinced me what must be done." She looked away toward the window, of what should have been done long ago.
Chapter 17. Alice. The police came early the next morning. I had expected them to, of course, knew that the time between when they would knock on my door and when I would be left in peace, in quiet, in that in-between state where I could still pretend that something horrible hadn't happened, that it was all just a dream, was inching closer and closer. John was dead. They had told me the day before, Maud and Lucy, though it had still failed to become real, to work itself into my mind as the truth, something concrete and unwavering that could not be challenged, changed, or altered. I had lain in bed, Maud tucking me in as though I were a child, an invalid, a problem she could never quite manage to shake, and I felt the word reverberating in my mind. Dead. It was all too familiar, and yet somehow foreign. It couldn't be true, I wanted to tell my aunt, feeling as she tugged and pulled at the sheets. John couldn't be gone, couldn't be dead. He was the one, I wanted to explain to her, the one who was supposed to pull me up and out of the depression, out of the darkness that had swirled around me ever since that bitter cold night in Vermont. Since before that, even. He couldn't be gone, couldn't be dead. My mind would simply not accept it. Not even later, when they showed me his body under the harsh, glaring lights of the coroner's office, the color draining from my face as I stepped backward, staggering, conscious all the while of Aunt Maud beside me, of the officer's eyes evaluating my every movement, every intake of breath. I felt them, all of them, waiting, watching, for the tears, for the hysterics, for a performance that I did not seem to have the energy to enact. I turned away, setting my face to stone. "Madame?" I looked up at the two officers, their faces hesitant, uncertain, as if they were afraid, I thought. I wanted to laugh then, for what on earth had they to fear from me? I wanted to know. I was moved to ask them. But then the weight of the moment, the emotions that I was supposed to be feeling, that they were expecting me to display, became all too much. I nodded at the men, a clipped little gesture, something like a bow, and started to back away, heading toward the door. It was the same feeling I had experienced at Café Haffa, at countless other moments in my life, when the panic had started rising in me, the feeling of being trapped threatening to overtake me, so that I needed nothing so much in that moment as to be able to leave the space I was confined within. Despite this, I paused, looking to my left, to my right, convinced that there was something missing, something I was forgetting. It was Lucy, I suddenly realized. I had been looking for Lucy. This time, I did laugh.
Madame?
I heard the officer speak again, could feel Aunt Maud's sharp eyes on me, but still I could not respond, could not do anything but turn and walk away, out of the coroner's office, out into the hallway filled with doors, though none of them seemed to hold the exit I was searching for. I pushed up against one and then another, each of them refusing to yield. There was no way out. I was trapped, stuck in this labyrinthine hall. A figure emerged in front of me.
Madame McAllister?
No one had ever called me by my married name. I thought about the absurdity of it, hearing it for the first time while standing only steps away from my husband's corpse. Shipley, I whispered, my voice trembling. My surname is Shipley. The man frowned.
All right, Madame Shipley.
He paused, indicating the door next to him.
Follow me, please.
The man standing in front of me was not particularly large, his eyes reaching just a fraction above my own. And yet there was something about him, something that made me pause, something that made my heart begin to pound in fear. He was quite obviously of a higher rank than the two previous officers that I had spoken with, and I wondered what he wanted. I looked at the door that he had pointed toward, filled with panic at the thought of what might be hidden just behind it. There was, too, somewhere at the back of my mind, the vague realization that I should ask exactly who he was and what he wanted. But the only question I could manage was, "Where are we going?"
"To my office,"
he answered simply, offering no more explanation than that. I felt a hand on my shoulder and turned to find Aunt Maud, a light sheen of sweat breaking just above her lip.
"You heard the man, Alice," she said, her voice terse. "Let's go inside."
The man frowned, disappointed, it seemed, that she would be accompanying us. His office was sparse, little else dotting the walls besides a thin layer of yellow paint that seemed to be peeling, flaking in the corners. I settled into one of two chairs placed in front of his desk, Aunt Maud taking the other. Once we were seated, the officer lowered himself into his own chair behind the desk and leaned forward.
"Madame Shipley," he began, "do you know of any reason why a man by the name of Youssef might have been in possession of your husband's articles?"
I shook my head, surprised by the question, for whatever it was that I had been expecting, it was not this. But then something poked, needled, and I remembered what Lucy had said the other night to the policeman about Youssef. "No," I whispered, my voice low and hoarse. "I have no idea." He frowned, watching me.
"Are you quite all right, madame?"
I considered telling him then, about Lucy, about how she had deliberately mentioned Youssef to the policeman, how she had, more than likely, been responsible for whatever it was that they were talking about. I considered telling him this and everything else that had happened. But then I noticed the way that he was looking at me, his features sharp and narrow, and the words died on my lips. "Could I have a glass of water, please?" I asked instead. He looked irritated at this request, but nonetheless signaled to one of his officers standing just outside the door. A few moments of silence passed until at last a glass of tepid water was placed in front of me. "Thank you," I murmured. I placed the glass back onto his desk, watching as a small puddle formed, the ring that encircled it eventually sinking into the wood beneath. I could feel Aunt Maud's eyes on me, but I could not bring myself to return her gaze. Not just yet.
I'm sorry, what did you say your name was?
I asked the man, stalling. He sat back in his chair and sighed.
My apologies, madame. I am Officer Ayub, he said. Now I understand you knew the man.
I frowned, placing a hand to my temple, wondering if anyone else had noticed just how stuffy and confined the office was. Who? I asked, not knowing in that moment who he was referring to.
Yusuf,
he responded, his voice curt, the word over-enunciated.
Or perhaps you knew him as Joseph. He is the man responsible for your husband's death, madame.
No, I responded, shaking my head at the impossibility of the idea. No, they had got it all wrong. I could feel Aunt Maud stir beside me.
No?
Ayub raised his eyebrows.
Do you mean that you do not know him, or that he is not the one responsible?
No, I don't know him, I said, wanting and failing to say the other as well.
That is not what my men reported to me.
Ayub's eyes narrowed.
They said that you were well acquainted.
No, that isn't true, I protested, worried that it had already progressed to this. From knowing him to well acquainted, there was a difference, I was well aware. I knew of him, but not him personally. John... I stopped, my voice halting for a moment, stumbling over his name. He warned me about him.
Warned you? Why?
Ayub asked. I shook my head. I don't know. To watch out for him, I suppose. To be careful if I ever ran into him while I was on my own. The officer seemed to consider this.
Your husband had met him, then?
I shook my head. No. But then I thought of Sabine, of the other life that he had lived apart from me. I don't know, I found myself admitting. I mean, I don't think so. Not that he ever mentioned. I reached for the glass of water again. The officer watched me, his face still, revealing nothing.
I'm confused, madame. If you had never met Yusuf and your husband had never met him, then why were you both scared of him?
We were never scared, I replied quickly.
No?
He frowned. No, I repeated, frustrated now. I don't know. John had told me stories about Yusuf, about how he had conned some tourists out of money.
And you were afraid he would do this to you as well? Con you out of money?
Again I shook my head. No, not really. It's just...
Just what, Madame Shipley?
He snapped. I felt a flush, could tell that it had broken out across my chest, its redness most likely unmistakable even in the grim, darkened setting of the room. I cleared my throat, but before I could speak, Aunt Maud stirred. Leaning forward, she placed a hand on the officer's desk.
What is this about, please?
Ayub tilted his head, clearly unsettled by the interruption, but doing his best to hide it.
Nothing at all, madame,
he finally said, with what seemed a reluctant smile.
We are only trying to establish a link between this young woman, her husband, and the perpetrator.
He turned back to me.
So you never met Yusuf?
I shook my head. I've told you this already. I have never met him.
That is interesting.
He sat back in his chair, a smile emerging on his previously blank face.
You see, we've spoken to the suspect, and he claims to be very well acquainted with you, Madame Shipley.
I stilled at his words. What do you mean?
He says that you know one another, that you met a few weeks back in a café outside Cinema Riff.
But I've never been to Cinema Riff, I protested. But even as I said the words, I realized it was Lucy. She was the one he was describing. She was the one who had somehow planted this idea, this trap, so that I had ended up here, in this particular office.
Lucy,
I breathed. A frown stole over Ayub's face.
Pardon, madame?
It's Lucy, I said again, only louder this time.
I don't understand,
Ayub said, glancing toward Aunt Maud. I hesitated, feeling my aunt's icy stare, her disapproval, but I brushed them aside, pushing ahead. I could remain quiet no longer, not when everything had become twisted and jumbled. They would need my help to sort through it, so that it made sense at last. Maud didn't see yet. She couldn't. But she would eventually.
Lucy Mason, I said, though my voice trembled. She's my old college roommate.
The frown remained.
And how does this relate to what has happened here?
Lucy only just recently arrived in Tangier, I began, and I believe that she might be involved.
Ayub shook his head.
Perhaps I am not understanding. Involved with what, exactly?
With all of it, I said, leaning toward the officer. With John's death, with this silly idea that I somehow know Yusuf, that I might somehow have something to do with it myself.
Ayub was quiet for a moment, but then he smiled and said,
It's interesting that you mention this, the idea that you might be involved. Yes, you see, Yusuf has also claimed that someone else is responsible. A tangerine, a woman.
He paused.
His good friend, Madame Alice Shipley.
What do you mean?
I demanded.
I mean that the man claims he is innocent.
Ayub shrugged.
He says that you, Madame Shipley, came to him asking questions about a woman, someone your husband had been seeing on the side. And then not shortly after that, he claims he saw the same woman attack and murder her husband.
Your husband, Madame Shipley. A scoff from beside me as my aunt demanded,
And you believe him?
Ayub waved away the question.
We know about Yusuf. We've been watching him now for years. Of course, he's only dabbled in petty theft before. Little schemes of no real consequence.
He paused.
This was quite surprising, and yet...
What?
I asked, my voice trembling.
I can imagine it, he said pointedly. If there was, perhaps, shall we say, a persuasive force,
he said.
Did you, Madame Shipley,
he said, emphasizing the latter word,
know about your husband's affair?
I froze, but before I could respond, Aunt Maud placed a hand on my shoulder. She leaned forward and whispered in a low, forceful tone, Monsieur, are you charging my niece with something today? He seemed to consider her words carefully.
Not at this moment, madame. This is only an informal chat, a chance for Madame Shipley to tell us anything she might know.
But I've just told you, I said. I had nothing to do with this man, and he didn't have anything to do with John. It's Lucy, not him.
No?
He removed several items from his pocket then, and placed them onto the table between us. I saw the leather wallet that John had purchased in the souks, a wallet that smelled of the city and conjured up memories and images that I would rather leave behind. It had been purchased the same day I had lost John in the market, had grown angry and confused and scared. But then, no, I realized, that hadn't been the same day at all. Those two had been separate and distinct. I shook my head, focusing my eyes, my mind, instead, on the other object Ayub had produced. A small silver item that I couldn't place at first. But then I heard its familiar clatter, saw its shape and detail, and I knew what it was, knew that it could only be one thing and nothing else. My mother's bracelet. The officer was watching me expectantly, a look of triumph already spreading across his features.
You recognize these, yes?
The room was hot, suffocating.
Yes,
I replied. The bracelet belonged to my mother.
But even as I said the words, I struggled to understand how it had come into his possession, to understand what sequence of events had placed that bracelet, one my mother had once held in the palm of her hands, had once worn around the curve of her wrist, into the rough, calloused hands of a stranger, miles and miles away from where I had last seen it.
"But it was most recently in your possession, yes?" the officer pressed. "That is, before you gave it away?"
"Yes," I continued, but then I shook my head. "No, I mean it belongs to me now, but no, I did not give it away," I said, my voice low and hoarse. He looked at me.
"If that is true, madame, then how do you think I have happened to come into possession of it?"
I struggled to speak.
"I don't know," I said, turning toward my aunt at last, my words spoken more to her than the officer. "I haven't a clue. I lost it when I was at Bennington. I thought at first Lucy had stolen it, but then she denied it. I haven't seen it since."
The officer leaned back in his chair.
"Shall I tell you where I found it?"
His eyes narrowed.
"Though I suspect you already know."
"I don't," I said. "Auntie!"
I reached out to take her hand.
"I promise I have no idea."
Aunt Maud said nothing.
"Your good friend Yusuf was found in possession of this bracelet."
He paused.
"Payment,"
he said, the word long and drawn out. I started, turning back to him.
"I beg your pardon?"
"Payment," he repeated. "That's why he claims you gave him the bracelet."
He gave a short laugh.
"He seemed to have no idea that it was worthless, a piece of metal and paste."
Maud shifted.
"Payment for what, exactly?"
The officer turned toward her.
"Papers, madame. According to Yusuf, Madame Shipley suggested that the police would know what she had done sooner or later. She wanted to make sure she was able to leave undetected before that happened."
"Papers. Lucy had obtained new papers from someone recently, and Lucy was the one who had befriended Yusuf all those weeks ago. Perhaps, though I didn't know why, Lucy had planned it all. But no, why on earth would this man ever agree to any of it when he had landed in jail? There would be no reason for pretense now. But then, perhaps he did not know that it was pretense. Perhaps he believed it. Believed that she was me. That she was called Alice."
I started.
"Madame?"
The officer frowned.
"The name," I gasped. "What was the name on the papers?"
"I beg your pardon?"
"The new passport," I said hurriedly. "What was the name on the new passport?"
The officer looked down at his notepad, turning a page or two calmly, carefully, leaving me to lean forward, gripping the handles of my chair until my knuckles were white.
"Alice, what is it?"
Aunt Maud asked. She looked down at my shaking fingers, and I released them quickly.
"The papers," I whispered, not wanting to disturb the officer. "It's the papers, don't you see?"
She frowned, and I hastened to explain.
"Lucy, she had new papers made, ones with Sophie Turner as the name."
"Alice,"
she began, the frown deepening between her brows.
"No,"
I interrupted, shaking my head.
"I'm right, I know I'm right. It makes sense. It's the only thing that makes sense."
I turned back toward the officer.
"Have you found it yet, the name?"
The officer looked up.
"He did not know the name. He said Madame was insistent she be put in touch with the forger personally so as not to incriminate him further."
I fell back against the chair.
"Madame,"
the officer began again, though his voice was distant now.
"We also went to speak with your husband's mistress. She was, however, not to be found. It seems she left the country, fled, rather, in fear of her life. It was, it appears, with the help of your husband, the night before he went missing. and from what we understand, he had plans to eventually join her in Europe.
I shook my head, feeling the words as they were absorbed one by one into my body.
I didn't push her,
I whispered, knowing as I did that it was the wrong thing to say. Both Ayub and Maud leaned forward quickly, words spilling from them both, loud and rushed, though I did not hear them, did not register them. Instead, I felt the blood drain from my face, felt the knowledge of it all hit me, sharp and accurate, so that it seemed my breath had been knocked out of me. I realized then, for the first time, what was happening, why this man was asking these questions. I turned to look at Aunt Maud to see if she too had realized. Her stony demeanor told me that she had, and I found myself wondering just how long she had known, whether she had figured it out from the beginning, from the moment the officer had pointed us through the door. My skin prickled. I need to be excused, I said, the words dulled so that I did not recognize them as my own. The officer watched me with those hardened eyes, any trace of kindness long dissipated.
There is just one more thing, he said.
I hesitated.
Yes?
He peered up at me.
Why did you not go to the police when you knew your husband was missing?
When I did not respond, he continued.
Or perhaps you did. That is also unclear. You see, my men claim that someone by the name of Alice Shipley telephoned the station. Only when they paid her a visit, she denied having made the telephone call.
I blinked.
It wasn't me, and I didn't know, not at first.
He frowned.
You didn't know that your husband was missing?
No,
I said, shaking my head, knowing how the words sounded, that no explanation would ever suffice. Still, I hastened to explain.
He was supposed to go somewhere, with a friend.
What friend?
I hesitated, suspecting what his next question would be.
His name is Charlie,
I responded. And then when he did indeed follow up by asking how he could get in touch with him, I answered, shaking my head.
I don't know.
You don't know how to get in touch with your husband's friend?
He asked, suspicion, doubt flooding his voice. My heart began to pound as I admitted,
No, I've only ever met him a couple of times. Charlie, I mean.
But that still does not explain how you knew.
About Charlie?
I asked, puzzled.
No, madame.
He shook his head.
That your husband was missing.
A man came to tell me, someone that John works with.
I paused, knowing once more that his next question would demand specifics I could not provide.
I don't know his name.
He didn't tell you?
No, he didn't.
He grimaced.
Pardon me for saying so, but there is a lot that you don't seem to know, madame. A lot that you don't seem to have answers for.
I considered this as I began to stand, turning away from the police officer. I felt Aunt Maud rise beside me, felt her at my back as I pushed the door open, and we were at last released into the hallway.
Madame?
Came the officer's voice again. I stopped, but did not turn.
We have been made aware that you recently closed your account with the local bank. With this in mind, we ask that you please surrender your passport before leaving the station today.
I nodded stiffly and let the door close behind us. Aunt Maud insisted that I accompany her back to the Hotel Continental. One of the oldest hotels in Tangier, its expansive white facade sat higher than the rest of the buildings it surrounded, as if in recognition of its significance. I had always thought it looked like something out of a fairy tale, only instead of a moat, there was the harbour. Instead of pillars, there were dozens of palm trees. And instead of royalty, there were artists and writers, all the names that were famous and meant something out there, beyond Tangier. It was strange, but I found that I could no longer imagine it, a world outside of this place, Morocco, one that existed at the same time, concurrently. It seemed as though everything, each and every strand of my life, was tied to this place, would always be tied to this place, no matter how much distance I were to put between us. I tried to remember if I had felt the same way about Bennington before I left, but it seemed so far away, as if that too could no longer exist under the blazing sun of Tangier, as if the hot, dusty city held the power to wipe clean the green forests, the rolling hills, the smell of damp leaves underfoot. I was certain, in that moment, that I would never see it again.
"Are you feeling ill?"
My aunt's voice cut through my thoughts. We sat across from one another, an elaborate tea service between us, on the patio overlooking the harbour. Up until that moment we had remained silent, our unspoken words a divide I could not figure out how to cross.
"No, I was only thinking," I began, setting my teacup down with a clatter.
She held up a hand to silence me.
"It's fine, Alice. You needn't say anything. We will figure out a solution, just as we did before."
I frowned, realizing she meant Bennington.
"Maud?"
I started again, the sound of her name causing her to look up, startled.
"You have to believe me. About Lucy."
"Alice, no,"
I cut in, refusing to listen.
"You have to believe me. You have to trust me when I tell you that she is the one responsible for all of this, just like before. You have to."
She shook her head, setting down her own teacup with an exasperated sigh.
"Enough, Alice,"
she commanded, though her voice was not as harsh as I believe she intended it to be. Instead, she sounded sad, tired, as if she had been having the same conversation for the entirety of her life.
"No more of this Lucy Mason business, I beg of you."
"But if you would just listen—"
"No, Alice," she cut in. "I can't. I can't go back there, not again."
She shook her head.
"After all that wretched business in Vermont, all you would talk about was Lucy. It was like you were obsessed."
She paused.
"There were girls who came forward, afterward. Girls who said they heard you fighting, that you said something that night."
I tried to remember.
"What did I say?"
Aunt Maud looked away.
"That you wished she would disappear."
She paused.
"And then she did."
"It was—"
I began to protest.
"Alice," she cut in again, "you must see how it all looks."
I shook my head, not understanding what she was saying.
"Lucy did it. Lucy is the one responsible, just like before."
"Alice," she began again, lowering her voice, "there is no evidence of that. There is no evidence that anyone is responsible at all. It was just an accident, something that no one can be held accountable for. It was tragic, yes, and I can see how you're still struggling with the injustice. It's entirely understandable. But blaming someone else, a girl who no one has seen since—"
She let her voice fade. I frowned, struggling once more to understand her aversion to the topic, to understand why instead of choosing to listen to her niece, to what she offered as truth, she preferred instead to sweep away all mention of Lucy entirely. And then I remembered her words, after the accident. "I will take care of everything." I inhaled sharply. That was it, then, the truth of the matter. The one that had always been there, but that I had refused to see until that moment. I looked up at my aunt, made sure to catch her eye, to hold it.
"Maud,"
I said, my voice level, even. And then I asked the question that had been floating between us, I now realized, for the past year.
"Maud, what do you think I've done?"
She paled. I waited for her to deny it, to tell me that I was being absurd, hysterical even. But then she broke my gaze, looking out to the port, to the sea just beyond, and whispered,
"I don't know, Alice."
She turned back to look at me.
And what's more, I don't know if you do either.
I could feel them then, the shadows, threatening. I remembered those days after my parents died, how everything had seemed heightened, but also dull and distant at the same time. Time had passed strangely. Hours had felt like days, and days had felt like hours. Most of that time I had spent in bed, my mind exhausted and racing, the lack of sleep causing me to blink rapidly, my dry and tired eyes struggling to determine what was real, what was tangible, and what had only been imagined by my fervent mind. This could not be how it all ended. I pushed the thought of my parents, of their death, from my mind. I ignored those dark spaces at the edges of my vision, the ones that seemed to grow, minute by minute. There had to be something left that I could do, something that might help to right the horrible, wretched mess that Lucy had once again created. I stood, knocking over my teacup as I did so, the light brown liquid running down the sides of the table onto the ground.
"I'm so sorry," I murmured. "Please excuse me, Auntie."
As I walked away from the Hotel Continental, leaving behind Maud, who looked stricken and confused at my hasty exit, I thought about what the police officer had said back at the station. Yes, there was a lot that I did not have answers for. That much was true. But I also knew the one person who did.
Chapter 18. Lucy. I peeled off my dress, the imposing belted black one I had worn on my first day in Tangier, and again, recently, for the sake of Maud. I did not imagine a girl like Sophie Turner wore trousers. The dress clung to my back, slick with sweat, as if reluctant to leave my body. A few minutes passed, and I wrestled furiously until I heard a slight rip, a slight give of the fabric, and then it was off and I was free, the defeated dress lying in a heap on the ground. I sighed. Part of me wanted to leave it there, to toss it out the window and into a trash heap, but I stuffed it into the bottom of my suitcase, hoping as I did so that the need for such pretense would soon be over. It was almost time to leave now. There was a part of me that had hesitated earlier that day, that had felt guilty even as I moved inside Yusuf's empty studio. He had waited his entire life to see Tangier free, and he was so close to it. It was only a matter of weeks now until that moment when Tangier would be entirely its own. I was aware of the injustice, even as I had placed John's blood-stained wallet onto the ground behind one of Yusuf's paintings, the bracelet already there somewhere, a down payment of my gratitude. It was not fair, I knew. He would spend the rest of his life in prison, and simply because he had done what I had always done myself, scratched and clawed, fought as hard as possible in order to get his own, in a world that refused to give it to him. Once again, I was struck by how similar we were, Yusuf and I, oppressed by the same forces, by men like John. And while we should have been allies, while this defeat of John should have made us partners, co-conspirators, we would be nothing but enemies now. My hand had paused at the sight of the painting resting on the easel. I had not asked to see it, had not bothered to look at it the last time I had been in his studio. A part of me later had wondered whether he had even been painting at all, whether it had truly been my portrait his brushstrokes had created. But about this, at least, he had been honest. A strange mix of blues, the shades of which I could not name, the painting displayed my features in startling clarity. It betrayed, I thought, just how closely he had been observing me these past weeks, for surely he had not seen all this in just the few moments that I had sat for him. There was something intimate, something that suggested a relationship existed between the artist and the subject. I knew little about art, but I had the sense that it was something that should make one feel, should make one think. It was already approaching evening, and I struggled in that moment, watching as the fading light cast its beams across the painting, caught between the desperate need to get away from the studio from Tangier, and yet hesitant to leave. It seemed all too sudden, as if I hadn't had time to prepare, to allow myself to mourn. Part of me wanted to leave it there as a reminder, proof that I was once there, that I had loved Tangier, had loved Alice in that moment. That it had all meant something. But then I thought of the painting remaining there for Yosef to look at, believing he had bested me, even if the illusion would last only for a moment or two longer. The idea unsettled me. I thought, too, of the police who would find it, who might pause long enough, particularly if Yosef decided to point in my direction when he realized his Alice was not the Alice. It would not do, I realized. I had reached out and took the painting. I now paused before lowering the blouse over my head, my eyes flickering to the mirror to what I saw reflected there. A young woman, handsome enough, but nothing that clamored for attention. I thought of Yosef's painting, of the shrewdness that he had captured. I relaxed my face, watching, working to soften my features, to rearrange myself into a girl called Sophie Turner, though I had already begun to suspect that she would not fit for much longer, her worth, her purpose diminishing with each and every step that I took. I reached for my suitcase, taking one last look around the apartment. We could have been happy here, I thought sadly. I closed the door and exited onto the streets below. I inhaled, taking in the scents of Tangier, reminding myself even as I did so that it might be the last time I found myself on her shores again. Moving through the markets, my eyes trailed over the tall mounds of spices, from the brilliant shades of squash-colored turmeric to the crushed rose petals and overflowing baskets of whole peppercorns. If I were a painter, an artist, this is where I would spend all my time, I decided. There was no better place to observe Tangier. And then, though I knew it was silly, that it was entirely too sentimental, dangerous even, I made my way toward the Casbah, toward the tombs and the cliff and the water beyond, one last time. In the end, I could not stop myself. Standing atop the cliff, determined to take in one last view of Tangier, I was struck by her beauty, by her mystery. I thought of the tale that Yosef had told me, the one about the beautiful woman luring men to their death. Perhaps it wasn't some mysterious woman at all, I thought now. Perhaps it was simply Tangier, Tingis. For in a way, I too had experienced a sort of death upon her shores. I had come to her as one thing and was now leaving as another. This metamorphosis, it seemed, was dependent on rebirth, and so death must also be a part of it, the two inherently linked. I removed the painting from under my arm, gave a quick look around to make sure that no one was watching, and released it into the water below. Lucy Mason had outlived her usefulness at last, though she had never been particularly useful to begin with, I thought with disdain. Born poor, uneducated, to a family that couldn't be bothered to care. In the end, her survival past the age of 10 was a miracle in itself. That she had found a way to survive in that garage, alone with her father, with the other men, that she had picked up one book and then another, teaching herself to read, to write, to earn a scholarship that promised her something more, something better. It should never have happened. She should have died long ago, just like her mother. Another forgotten life, another forgotten death. With no one left to mourn, to remember. I stood for a moment or two longer, imagining the waves as flames of a fire, watching as they lapped, as they drowned and devoured the last and final traces of Lucy Mason. I moved away from the cliffs, realizing that time had been slipping away from me, that the ferry would soon be arriving. Heading toward the port, I kept my eyes focused, kept my gaze averted as I walked, avoiding those very same spots where only moments before I had walked. Eagerly, greedily, hungry for a reminder, a souvenir of Tangier. I thought of that first day, of the sellers that had greeted me, called out to me, trying and failing to get me to part with my money. I saw them again as I moved toward the port, and then, yes, I knew it was him, that very same mosquito who had pursued me through the streets as I had sought to find Alice's flat that first day, who had slipped away only moments before I had stood beneath her balcony, watching her from a distance. He moved toward me now, a smile emerging on his face.
"Madame needs a tour guide?"
he asked eagerly. I shook my head and indicated the boat just beyond. He nodded in response and opened his jacket, revealing a hidden layer of cheap, shiny bracelets and rings, the kind that would no doubt stain one's skin green within a few days.
"A trinket, madame," he offered, "to remember your journey."
I nodded, reaching for my last few francs. "Here," I said, handing over the coins. He rewarded me with one of the bracelets.
"A reminder, madame," he said, smiling, "of your time in Tangier."
I thanked him and headed toward the port. As I boarded, I let the trinket drop from my hand into the Mediterranean, though I did not bother to watch as it sank. Letting out a small laugh, I thought of what I had wanted to say to the mosquito, that the bracelet or any other of his treasures were unnecessary, that I didn't need anything to remind me of Tangier, of her. After all, I was a tangerine. I would never forget.
Chapter 19. Alice. In some ways, Malabata prison was not so grim as I had anticipated. Sitting on the eastern outskirts of the city, it stood, a vast, grand building rising up in front of me, so that I was immediately reminded of the Hotel Continental. I felt a chill run through me. The two structures could not have been more different, and yet there was something in them that felt strangely familiar, a sense of the imposing stature that radiated from both. Inside, I was conducted through a series of hallways before passing at last into what appeared to be some sort of makeshift cell, held apart from the rest of the prison. Yusuf stood when I entered.
"I am so famous now, they decided I must have my own room," he said by way of greeting, indicating his surroundings.
He smiled, watching as I assessed the tiny enclosure, the prison within a prison that they had created for him. I smiled weakly in response, though I suspected he knew the truth. For while Tangier could most certainly be a dangerous place, I had learned from John that most of the criminals within the walls of Malabata were thieves and pimps, the most common offense the smuggling of kif from the mountains and into the city. A dangerous criminal like Yusuf would not sit well with either the prisoners or the guards, and so they had cordoned him off, creating a room that held him apart from the rest of the populace, with only one solitary window for company. I cleared my throat. "I wanted to speak with you about Lucy Mason." Yusuf, who occupied the room's only chair, tipped the frame of it against the wall in what seemed a dangerous balancing act.
"You are not the first person to mention that name to me," he observed, shaking his head with a short laugh.
He let the chair fall back onto the ground with a clatter.
"I am sorry to disappoint you, madame, but I do not know anyone by that name."
"She was the woman whom you met several weeks ago in the Grand Soko," I said. He inclined his head, an indication, I thought, that was meant to let me know that he was listening, that I should continue. "You see, monsieur, I am Alice Shipley." His eyes widened at this, his eyebrows raising just an inch or two. He remained silent, though his eyes sought, appraised. Finally he said,
"I see."
"The woman you met," I continued, eager now to have it all out in the open, "used my name, though I'm not sure why, but I think it was for this reason, because she planned this, all of it, somehow, from the very beginning." I waited for a response, and when there was none, I said,
So you see, you have to tell them.
He smiled.
Tell what to whom, madame?
The police,
I replied, confused that he did not understand, that he did not see.
You have to tell them what I've just told you.
That a tangerine lied to me, gave me a false name.
He shrugged.
That is hardly news.
I shook my head.
You must tell them that I am not Alice, or not the Alice that you know, that I am not the one you saw that night when John was killed.
Yes, I could tell them this.
He paused.
But why would they believe me?
I sputtered, confused. How could he not see it, I wondered, that this was not only my way out, but his as well, his one chance to clear his name and be free of the shackles that her lies had imposed upon him. They have to, I said.
He shook his head.
Madame, let me tell you what the police will say. That you came here to convince me to lie. After all, why would you visit a man in prison you did not know? For what other reason than to ask him to save your life, since his own is already lost?
I stood, speechless.
They will twist everything, he continued. Your words, your intentions, until they fit their own. This is their way. Nothing will change that. So you see, it is an impossible situation.
But it's not right, I said. Though the words came out soft, meek. She can't get away with it. Surely this place won't let her get away with it.
He raised his eyebrows.
This place?
I didn't mean...
I began hastily, anxious to explain. But then I fell silent, wondering if I hadn't meant exactly that. Tangier. This place. This strange, lawless city that belonged to everyone... and no one. Yusuf settled back into his chair.
Let me tell you something a friend once told me. He works at the Hotel Continental. Do you know it?
Yes,
I replied, a blush starting on my cheeks at the mention of it. Looking at the man in front of me, I wondered how often he had sat down to tea there, or passed through its doors at all. It struck me as odd, the idea that he belonged to this city and it to him, and yet the places, the spaces of the city, did not.
Yes, I repeated. I know it.
He nodded.
My friend there is the manager of the hotel. He told me once about a group of tourists that had come to stay. Americans, he said. Upon departing the ferry... one of the first things they asked him was if Tangier was safe.
Yusuf paused then, affixing me with a gaze that made me grow uneasy. For at his words, all I could think of was John, of his body on the metal table of the coroner.
No, I wanted to say, to shout. No, Tangier was not safe. Nothing I knew about it suggested otherwise. And nothing Yusuf, a son of Tangier, could say would change that.
But then I looked at him, sitting there before me, imprisoned for a crime he did not commit, and I felt I could not say the words aloud.
I don't know,
I offered instead.
Well, Yusuf said, shifting in his seat. He asked them this. When at home... if a strange man was to approach you, one with a jagged scar on his face,
he began, indicating his own visage as if the deformity could be viewed there.
Would you stop to see what he wanted?
He leaned forward.
Would you?
He demanded, the last words spoken more harshly.
No,
I answered quickly.
No, he repeated. No, of course not. So why would you stop to talk to such a man here, only to be surprised when something bad happens later?
He shook his head ruefully.
If you are not smart at home, he said, tapping his head, you will not be smart here. If you run into trouble at home, do not be surprised to run into trouble here. You are still the same person. Tangier can be magic, but even she is not a miracle worker.
I nodded, refusing in that moment to consider the implications of his words, of the truth I suspected that they held, of what they might mean for me. No, about me.
But what will you do?
I asked, realizing that all other questions were lost to me.
I will survive.
He shrugged.
Nothing is forever, Alice Shipley.
The taxi back to the flat could have dropped me outside the front door, but I found myself restless to be outside, to be walking in the fresh air, though it felt thick and languorous already. Still, it was nothing compared to the temperature in the back seat of the taxi, the windows shut tightly, as if the driver feared the air itself. I puzzled over Yusuf's words, could not help but feel the sharp sting of them, as if they had been a rebuke intended solely for me. After all, he was right. How could I blame this place, Tangier, when I had brought the problems myself? They had not manifested out of the cracks and corners of the sidewalks around me. No, they had been born and bred somewhere else, had followed me here because I had ignored them, had allowed the fog to hide what I already knew. It was my fault. What had happened with Tom, with John, all of it. There was no one else to blame, only myself and Lucy. She had taken everything from me, but I had let her. The realization stirred something, so that as I made my way back to the flat, I increased my pace, desperate to confront her on my own at last, feeling, in that moment, as though this is where we had been headed for some time now, the two of us, standing before one another, all our secrets and lies exposed. I walked faster, turning one corner and then another, stumbling against locals, against the vibrant blues, pinks and yellows of doorways, stopping and starting several times over in confusion. I realized soon enough, my heart hammering in my chest, that I was lost, and that there was someone following me. It hit me in the chest as I struggled to breathe, as I increased my speed, my eyes scanning over every building, every landmark, searching for something that looked familiar, that whispered of home. I thought of the man with the scar, positive that it had been him, only a few days before, following me through the streets. I had been frightened then, and though I was still frightened now, I was tired of running. And so I stopped, quickly and without warning. I felt the force of another body smack into my own. My handbag was knocked from my arm, and its contents went scattering across the pavement. A tube of lipstick, a container of rouge, the few coins that had fallen to the bottom. I had forgotten about them until that moment, and my gaze fixated on them as they fell, the bright silver flittering like leaves in the air around me. I turned, expecting to find the man standing there. But no, it was a woman. It was her, Lucy. "What do you want?" I demanded, scurrying to grab my purse, my belongings, to place a few feet of distance between us. I fumbled, wondering how long she had been following me, whether she knew about the police station, about the horrible thing that Aunt Maud had confessed afterward. I imagined her listening around the corner, smiling, taking pleasure in my displeasure. Hoisting my handbag onto my shoulder, I began to move away. But that monstrous grin of hers, the same one that she had fixed on me the other night, was all that I could see. I thought of my father, of his teasing voice, my little Alice in Wonderland.
"Why are you doing this?"
I shouted now, ready at last, feeling the rage course through my veins. But when I looked up at her, what I saw made me stop and blink. It was Lucy. I had been certain. But no, I could see now that I had been wrong. That it was a woman, yes, but not Lucy. Not anyone who even looked like her, not really. This woman was older, taller. She was fair where Lucy was dark. And she was watching me with concern, her hand pressed up against her mouth, her eyes wide with an expression that I could not manage to read. I shook my head.
"I'm sorry," I murmured. "Je suis désolée."
I continued, moving my head, oddly, I thought, though I could not stop the gesture, a funny tilt that looked as though I were